This is WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. Is today's version of youth sports draining the fun out of the game? Participation can be a terrific experience for a child and, of course, challenging. As a former soccer mom, I recall Saturdays and Sundays spent on the field watching my kids in motion. At times, their play was, to my eyes anyway, a thing of beauty, and at other times, not so much. There was disappointment and triumph, along with the fresh air and exercise, and there was also, at times, a lot of pressure. This hour, we'll talk about the challenges facing today's young athletes. There is often pressure to perform, to play the same game year-round, spend many hours at practice, shoot for a college scholarship, and then there's the expense, which can cost the family thousands of dollars. Playing sports as a kid can be enormously beneficial, but fewer children are participating. In this hour, we'll take a look at some of the reasons why. We're going to begin with expense, which is putting sports out of the reach of many, particularly low-income children. Beth Devine is executive director of the Philadelphia Youth Sports Collaborative. She's leading a new initiative called Game on Philly, which is working to create more accessible, quality youth sports programs around the city. And Beth is also the founder of Philly Girls in Motion. Beth Devine, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
And before I forget, let's get the number out. 888-477-9999. 9499 is the number to call if you'd like to jump into the conversation. You can send us an email to Radio Times at whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Beth, you co-authored an op-ed this summer in the Philadelphia Inquirer with David Montgomery, chairman of the Phillies. And I'm paraphrasing here, but you open the piece by saying, Philadelphia sports are having a moment. Think Eagles, maybe Phillies. But that Philadelphia's kids are not sharing in that moment, and they should be. Elaborate, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, what we find when we look around at the city is that the opportunities to play, to just go out and play and join a rec league, and are not there for most kids. I mean, there's opportunities and there's a lot of really good people doing really good things, but we find that a lot of that burden to provide is falling to the nonprofit community. Our collaborative, we work with 35 nonprofits that do sports-based youth development. So a lot of times, particularly in elementary schools and middle schools, any sport that's there is being provided by kind of an outside entity, and the system that you see in other places like the suburbs where there's after-school sports and parent coaches just is not in place. And our job is to take a look at where those inequities lie and try to see if we can't create new opportunities for youth to participate.
Well, let's talk about why there are relatively few opportunities. Expense is one.
Expense is definitely one. I mean, the whole youth sports arena has moved to a pay-to-play model.
Meaning?
Meaning that, travel teams start to exist when you're 8 years old now. I mean, I wasn't on my first travel team till I was 13 or 14. That's a big difference. And people see an opportunity. I mean, the youth sports industry is at $14.5 billion nationwide. Yeah. Yet when you go into a city, kids don't even have a rec league in their neighborhood. So, it's really, in my mind, just unfair. And it kind of broke my heart to learn of it when I started working with girls in South Philadelphia, to know that when we were finished a basketball clinic, that there was nothing else. There wasn't a league. There wasn't a
team at school. How about after school sports?
After school sports, the school district has their, traditional after school sports leagues, but they don't start till middle school. And in our experience, if you don't get a kid started in second or third grade, particularly girls, by middle school, they probably have already dropped off. And and we know from just working with the Department of Health that kids in Philadelphia, particularly, one out of five gets absolutely no exercise at all. Less than 20% are seeing 60 minutes of activity in an entire week.
And how much should they see per day?
They should see 60 minutes per day. And sports is just a fun way to do that. Sports, physical activity, group exercise classes, those types of things should be brought into the schools. And so we're looking to find the opportunities that exist and support the efforts that are already going on. I don't want to sit here and say nothing's happening. There's people doing good things. But we just see that there's an inequity and that we're trying to just, for lack of a better term, level the playing field.
So if kids aren't getting exercise, what are the negative effects?
Well, I mean, I'm reading a book called Spark, and it goes into the actual brain chemistry that comes along with physical activity. And whether you get that by running around the block or walking your dog or walking somewhere or up and down the steps or playing a sport, you learn better, you feel better, it fights off depression, it fights off anxiety. And we have so much pressure on kids in our society, whether that it's pressure because they're well-to-do and they have the pressures of that life, or whether they're underserved or under-resourced and they have the pressures of that life, the trauma that comes with a lot of kids' lives these days, exercise helps all that. And so we know the science, we know the research, but we're not getting it done. You know, we look at our schools and we look at our rec leagues and we look at our spaces and they're not full with kids playing. You know, we've taken play out of their lives somehow over the years. And so, you know, our hope is that our initiative can reintroduce those opportunities in a manner that's done by trained professional coaches who understand trauma-informed coaching, who understand what it means to be a mentor and what you could potentially mean in that child's life, and not necessarily go in with the lens of let's find the next professional athlete in this group. Let's just give them play for 4 or 5 years until they figure out if they want to be an athlete.
And this initiative is called Game On Philly.
It is.
How much money are we looking at? You've got to build infrastructure too. I mean, in many areas of the city, particularly in impoverished areas, you don't have fields kids can go to knock a ball around. I know out in the suburbs where I live, there's a huge complex not too far where soccer practices were held, and you don't necessarily have that. So let's talk about some of that.
Well, I think we do have that, and I think that the issue is whether it's being utilized properly or not. I mean,
and upkeep.
Upkeep is there, but if you look at our parks and recreation system exists, and while it's not always completely well-resourced, it's there. And we have a lot of volunteer groups who have started sports out in those spaces and are putting the money they need into it with support from the city where they need to jump in and help make sure fields are lined or cleaned or mowed or whatever it might be. I think
so. The infrastructure is there, not to interrupt you. It is there.
I think so. I mean, to a degree. It probably needs a little work, but I think it's there. And our job is really to align the partners. We look at ourselves as a backbone organization who can kind of play point guard, you know, get everybody involved in the game to get the goal of getting more kids engaged done. And, you know, we look to our partners, our friends over at Read by Fourth, who are doing that. They have 190 some partners now that are helping do the work. And we're looking at ourselves as much like that organization where we're going to align these partners to help get this work done.
So Game On Philly, if I'm reading the information that was given me correctly, also focuses on kids in middle school and getting them involved. Why?
Well, we saw an opportunity in fourth to eighth grade, which encompasses middle school and even a little bit younger. I mean, in my perfect world, we start in third grade or second and third grade. But it's because if you go in with eighth graders, in most cases, it's too late, particularly for girls. If they don't get started early, they're not going to feel confident in picking up a brand new sport at eighth grade. And then by then life jumps in, you know, and you have teenagers who really are like, I'm not going to do that. So when we get kids young in healthy physical activity, two things will happen. One is they get that experience of being on a team, of knowing there's a coach that has their back or a player or teammate that has their back and has that community that they may not have at home. But so that's the sport piece is very important, but also the piece of just finding something you really like to do, has shown to be, it enables a child to get involved in that and keep going. You know, if you get kids that are playing and being active at a young age, it's very likely they're going to be active at when they're adults, and then they pass that on to their kids. So it just kind of creates a healthier cycle if you get kids engaged at a younger age.
And there's also a spillover in performance in school,
absolutely,
performance after school, work, and et cetera?
Everything. All the research is there. It all points to this is good. And we say, if it's sports, great. If it's yoga, great. If it's, you know, dance or Zumba or whatever it might be, that's awesome. Get the kids moving. But we also are wide open to, in the after-school time space, there should be arts, there should be theater, there should be all these things that get a kid engaged in their tribe and their community so that they can feel better about themselves, because it turns into more positive effects everywhere.
So, again, let's get back to personal expense. You know, it can cost a family thousands of dollars to participate in a sport, depending on the sport. Let's start with soccer for a moment, which is one of, I think, the less expensive sports.
Theoretically, it should be.
But, you know, to a family who might be listening to this show saying, you know, I still can't afford this. You know, I'd love to get my kid involved. What do I do? How do I go about this? What would you say?
Yeah, and that's where I would seek out opportunities within Parks and Rec. I mean, Parks and Rec soccer is there. It exists. There's a really robust soccer community here in Philadelphia. Actually, a lot of the providers have gotten together over the past year to say, how do we keep soccer in Philadelphia and keep it affordable and keep it accessible? A lot of the clubs did go to that travel model pretty early, but I think there's sort of a trend there because they see that, you know, we don't have to take nine-year-olds to Delaware to play other nine-year-olds. There's plenty of nine-year-olds here in Philadelphia. So, but I do see the challenge where a family wants to get engaged. And I think that's where things like the Unity Youth League that's growing out of the rec department right now, we're going to help them grow to 20 sites this year because it's growing exponentially, and it's a low cost after school offering, and that's a great opportunity for kids. And we would love that to be in every single on every single field in the city, because it's a good community. It feeds into the Unity Cup. Everything kind of ties together, so it's a way to get kids from different communities, from different ethnicities, engaged in low cost soccer. And we hope to do that in other sports as well.
And I was going to say across the board with sports. So a family might be able, would they be able to contact Game On Philly for more information?
We can definitely turn them on to different providers who, you know, might be in their neighborhoods. And there's a great resource that the city's going to provide called CitySpan, and there's going to be a program locator. So we're encouraging all of our providers to make sure that every program they offer is in the CitySpan program locator, which I believe is set to launch in January. So that's going to be a great resource for parents and teachers and schools to get kids involved in things in their neighborhoods.
And how about people who might want to help out, volunteer coaches? Are you looking for folks like that?
We absolutely are. I mean, what part of our entire push is to train existing coaches on some really specific child support and positive youth development principles, but also to engage and grow grassroots, really. We want people from neighborhoods to understand and to know that they have support if they want to start a rec league for kids or if they want to get engaged in coaching. So, you know, anybody that wanted to participate in any way, just reach out. I mean, we're available at our gameonphilly.com website has a lot of information. There's a great sweepstakes going on there right now that helps support the issue, the cause, and you can, you know, find yourself at the Eagles game or Phillies games and all that. So there's a lot of opportunity there. So check out that website at gameonphilly.com for a lot of information, and we'll work with anybody that's interested in helping kids.
So, Beth Devine, realistically, where do you want to see this effort in 5 years? Got about 20 seconds. What do you want to see in the city, and how do you want to see youth participation increase?
We want to see hundreds of quality trained coaches working in new opportunity spaces. So elementary schools, anywhere with a gym, anywhere with a field. We want to make sure that we have trained people in place to make sure that kids have a good quality sports experience at a young age.
All right, we're talking about participation in youth sports. Beth Devine, thank you so much for joining us, Executive Director of Philadelphia Youth Sports Collaborative. Up next, sports psychologist Travis Dorsch. Stay with us as Radio Times continues. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. We're focusing this hour on why fewer kids are playing youth sports. The money involved, the pressure to excel, the time commitment, injuries, sometimes parents. We're joined now by sports psychologist Travis Dorsch, an assistant professor and founding director of the Families and Sport Lab at Utah State University. Travis was also a kicker and punter at Purdue, and he played for a while with the Bengals. Welcome to Radio Times, Travis.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Let me get that number out again, 888-477-9499. Also, if you'd like, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. So, Travis Dorsch, let's get into the pressure for a moment that many young athletes are experiencing. Pressure which seems to have intensified in recent decades. First, let's talk about the that elusive college scholarship. I remember as a parent hearing chatter on the sidelines from parents about perhaps the potential for any child for landing a college scholarship, or a child's dreams about maybe playing professionally. Is this a realistic dream?
Well, the short answer is for some it is, you know, but you use the word elusive, and I think that's really an appropriate word. Our data tell us across our country, and it varies by sport for sure, but our data tell us that about 20% of young athletes are going to get the chance to go on and play in high school. And of those, about 2% are going to get the chance to go play in college. And of course, college is broadly defined, right? We have Division I, Division II, Division III. We have scholarship. We have non-scholarship. So I think there is this dream of, you know, the full ride, right? But even of the kids who are good enough to go on and play in college, only about 50% of those will have some form of a scholarship. And of those, only about 50% of those will be on full scholarship. So you can really start to begin to see with this breakdown that your child going to college for quote-unquote free really is the top of the top.
So what role might this expectation play in the pressure some children feel in youth sports?
It's really an important question. And I think, you know, we did a study a couple of years ago that's been published in Family Relations, and our data indicate that the more money that families are spending to try and pursue that college scholarship, we're seeing children that perceive more pressure from the parents. And that pressure may be real, it may not be real, but the children are perceiving it. And that pressure, that perception of pressure, leads the children typically to actually enjoy their sport experience less, kind of in the moment as they're progressing, but then also to be less likely to want to continue playing in future seasons. So sort of the downstream impact of trying to give our kids a better opportunity is oftentimes the exact opposite. You know, we burn them out. We teach them that maybe they don't want to be in sport, that maybe other pursuits might be a better use of their time.
And as we mentioned earlier in the show, for those families who can afford it, youth sports can be quite a financial investment of thousands of dollars, you know, fees and camps and equipment and travel. In your opinion, how should parents view this investment? What is the payoff?
Well, yeah, you used an impactful word there, payoff, right? We oftentimes think of the word investment, right? We're investing in our kids' future. But the problem with those words is you expect some sort of return, right? And I think we all put our kids in sports because we do expect some sort of return, whether that's the college scholarship, as you mentioned, or more likely it's because we want them to grow up and learn life skills and learn to respect authority and become good teammates and all these things that we think about as positive assets or positive outcomes from sport. The problem is all too often I think we lose sight of those original goals for signing our kids up when they're six, and it becomes all about the competition. It becomes all about those tangible markers of success, like a varsity letter, like a college scholarship, like gulp playing professionally. So I think the more that we can kind of keep our heads on straight, not think about this as an investment where we expect a tangible return, but think about it as, you know, why did we sign our kids up in the first place?
Where does fun figure in?
You know, fun's a tough word. Fun's an important word, but fun is a word that we all define differently. To a lot of kids, you know, fun is winning. To a lot of other kids, fun is being the best dandelion picker, you know, on the soccer field. So I think we can use the word fun, but we need to be careful, and we need to understand that this occurs at an individual level, at a family level, at a child level, and really have those tough conversations with the kids, you know, weekly, by season, every year. What do you want to get out of this experience? And then we as parents, we as coaches, the adults in the room, need to help facilitate those sorts of processes and outcomes that the kids want to engage in, because ultimately that's what it's all about.
Well, and since you mentioned that each child is unique, as a parent, how do you recognize when your child is not having fun?
Well, again, I think those conversations are paramount. I think, you know, at the very minimum, having the conversation at the beginning and the end of each season, but really this should be an ongoing conversation as you're in the minivan on the way to and from games, as you're around the dinner table, you know, hey, what do you want to get out of this game this week, this season? What are you enjoying? What are you not enjoying? How can I as a parent help? What can we do as a family to, you know, to facilitate your experience? And it sounds corny to have those conversations, but all too often I think we misread each other. And kids many times don't want to speak up to their parents. They just kind of want to put their headphones on in the back of the car and get to and from practice and games. So, you know, engaging in those conversations. And I think when we engage our children, they're more likely to open up and share with us, you know, what they're really trying to get out of the experience. And again, this is not sort of the soft, touchy-feely, you know, everything is about fun approach. This is the approach of, hey, I want my kid to get out of it what they want to get out of it, and I'm here to help them do that.
So Travis Dorsch, as many of us know, there is sometimes, and not all the time, but sometimes anger on the sidelines. And referees are very often a target. Some of these refs are, you know, children, they're teens themselves. I was reading a recent New York Times article which told the story of one ref who was punched by parents. Others are berated by fans and parents. That's probably what's happening more often when we're talking about anger. What's happening, in your opinion, there on the sidelines when this happens, when refs are the target of angry parents, and what is the effect on the kids who are playing?
Yeah, that's a tough question. There is some work being done. There's some empirical evidence, but also some anecdotal evidence that this is one of the main reasons that there's a shortage of referees today, is they're just flat out kind of sick of the abuse. And I think, you know, that's a fair statement in many cases. Now, of course, this varies by level. You're not going to see as much abuse at the six-year-old rec soccer league as you would maybe on a, you know, a U14 travel league where there's an opportunity to go to a national tournament at stake, right? I mean, yeah. we get more invested as the stakes get higher. But here comes that word investment again. And I think as parents invest in the opportunity, there's more chance for them to feel slighted, or for them to feel like their child is getting slighted by what they perceive as a bad call, and get really wrapped up in this. And ultimately, this comes back, I think, to just this sort of visceral engagement in sport, this sort of living vicariously through our child's experiences. And I think as humans, as parents, we all want what's best for our children, right? And when they get detention at school or get a poor grade on a test or get what we perceive as a bad call in the soccer field, it's easy for us to, because they're our kin, to believe that, you know what, it's not their fault, it's someone else's fault. So we go after, you know, that teacher who gave them a C or that ref who made the call. And I think that's human nature, but to the extent that we as parents can be sort of introspective about, hey, you know, this is part of the process. Maybe it was a bad call, but what can we learn from that as an athlete? What can we teach our kids as a parent from this experience? We're going to get some bad calls in life, metaphorically speaking. How do we respond to that? How do we move forward?
Yeah, just want to get some quick thoughts on this story. Brian Barlow's a youth soccer referee. His 12-year-old daughter's a ref, and he told the New York Times that one time she had to stay inside a building for an hour and a half after a game to protect her from threats made by parents who are upset by calls. Again, this is a 12-year-old. And here's what he's done. Barlow's posting videos he's received of parents behaving badly, and he says, this is starting to alter sideline behavior because they don't want to end up on his Facebook page. It sounds like a rather drastic solution, but if parents can't reset, I mean, what do you think? How do you think the professional piece of it should respond?
Well, this is a hard question because you're talking about, in this story at least, a 12-year-old, and how much power does a 12-year-old feel to ask or tell a parent to remove themselves from the situation, to send them off the field, to send them to their car, to say, you know, you're out of here. That's a tough ask for an adolescent, a young adolescent, to do that. And I think, you know, the more that we can sort of self-police to a certain extent, the more that we have grown-ups on the sidelines who can act as grown-ups and sort of create a social atmosphere where that's just not acceptable, you know, then we'll be in better shape. And I think, you know, you see these pop up on the news every once in a while. You see this website that this referee has created. You see things on social media. Yeah. A lot of times these are happening in social climates where this is sort of acceptable behavior. It's sometimes even a groupthink or a mob rule where you see a lot of parents acting this way. So what we need to do is non-normalize this, make this seem like something that's extraordinary, such that we react to it in a way that makes it not okay.
Let's talk about the tendency toward having children play year-round in one particular sport, because perhaps they do have some talent. And yep. If you're going to take a season yep. off, you might lose some ground. Pros and cons there, Travis.
Yeah, and this is a very nuanced question. There are pros and there are cons. You know, I think the key is that we keep the development of the child in mind. You know, is it appropriate for a 5 or a 6-year-old to play one sport year-round and be playing it 6 days a week? Likely not. Is it okay for a 16 or 17-year-old to do that? The answer probably to that is yes. And I think, it depends on, first and foremost, what are the child's goals and how do those sort of mesh with what the family's able to provide. But secondly, what's developmentally appropriate, you know, and it depends on the sport too, right? If you think about for maybe a figure skater or a gymnast, these sports where young athletes peak earlier on and Olympic age is, you know, 16 to 20, it's maybe okay to specialize a little bit earlier, but sports like power, strength, and endurance sports like football or even endurance running and things of this nature, there's no reason for a young child to be playing this year round. Now, when we juxtapose that with what we know from the motor development literature, and that is there's a lot of transfer that takes place across sports. You know, said differently, an 8-year-old who's out there playing soccer is becoming a better basketball player, and vice versa, and across other different sports as well. So I think we as parents, as coaches, need to recognize that until a child grows into his or her body and mind and emotion, they're not in a position to pick a sport to play year-round and to specialize in. We need to let them, you know, get through puberty or at least into puberty and start to see, what is my body ultimately going to look like? What do I really enjoy, most importantly? What am I good at? And then it's okay to start winnowing down, you know, from 2, 3, and 4 sports down into maybe 1 or 2 that we're good at and that we love.
Okay. Travis Dorsch, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time on Radio Times.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Travis is a sports psychologist and assistant professor and founding director of the Families in Sport Lab at Utah State University. And we're spending the hour looking at youth sports and the decline in the number of young athletes who are participating. Joining us now, Tom Ferry, executive director of the Sports and Society Program at the Aspen Institute, and Project Play, an initiative that works to build healthy communities through sports. Tom is also a longtime journalist who's reported on youth sports, and great to have you along with us, Tom.
Good to be here.
So let's again go back to the concept of fun for just a moment. Youth sports in this country is an enterprise worth nearly $15 billion, yet fewer children are participating. And you ask in a recent piece for the BBC, could it be that some children have been driven away from sport by adults, forgetting this is all supposed to be fun? Travis addressed fun for us. Tell us about your perspective of the place in youth sports that fun should hold as opposed to everything else.
Well, I mean, it depends who you talk to. If you talk to adults, I think fun is part of the reason why they sign their kids up for sports, but they're also looking for development outcomes. So, you know, they see the world that their children are going to enter, and they want them to have certain characteristics. They want them to have resilience and competitiveness and, you know, teamwork skills and things that they see will help them in, you know, socially, educationally, and just as they advance through life. So when you're that development focused, fun itself can be lost in the equation. Now, if you talk to kids, that's pretty much all they want to have is fun. The challenge is just how they define fun, right? I mean, you know, George Washington University, as you may know, looked at, you know, asked kids, how do you define fun? And they gave 81 reasons. Mm-hmm. And they said, okay, well, now can you rank them? And they did. And what was interesting is a lot of the things that parents think are fun, so trophies and travel tournaments and this kind of thing is really not very high on the list of what kids want. What they define fun as is, having access to the action, playing time, having a chance to test themselves and compete, playing for a coach who respects them, and having a social experience with their friends. I mean, just try to think back to childhood and how challenging it can be to be, you know, you want to be part of a group and you want to have good relationships and friendships are being formed. And really, you know, sport is a great place to do that and to develop some of the self-esteem and just makes you feel good about yourself, you know? And so that's what kids want. It's just different than what parents want.
So is there a marriage in there someplace, some kind of meeting of common ground between what the kids want and what parents want that's healthy? Could you define that for us?
I mean, look, I think if it's called youth sports, it ought to start with what youth want. I mean, and we should also recognize that if you give kids what they want, if you design youth sports for youth, by youth, you're more likely to create, you know, a sticky experience, meaning one that is they're going to find attractive and want to sign up for year after year. So I think, you know, absolutely start with what kids want, ask them what they want, do that through surveys, through preseason conversations, through, you know, just really starting with their, where, you know, meet them where they're at, and then layer on your development outcomes on top of that. But when you do that, you make sure you actually know what the heck you're talking about. And the problem with a lot of youth sports today is it's ignorant of what proper athletic development or even child development research says is useful in developing these type of traits.
So how do you find a good program as a parent?
I think, you ask certain questions, you know, and on our website, we created something called the Project Play Parent Checklist for kids of really three different types. One are kids ages 6 to 12 who are playing sports right now, and the type of questions you should ask of yourself, your child, and sport providers. And we also created a checklist for kids ages 6 to 12 who are not playing sports, who are stuck on the couch, you know, parents can use. And then kids ages 0 to 5 as you're preparing for sports. So it depends on which age and what type of kid you're talking about. But let's take the kid who is involved in sports right now. And you just want to make sure they're in a good experience. And the type of questions you should be asking are, of that program, are your coaches trained in the key competencies in working with kids? So if someone is coaching soccer, do they know skills and tactics? Have they gotten any training from the U.S. Soccer Federation, even like a very low-level license or otherwise, you know, so they can set up a plan? I mean, kids do want to be in environments where they get better. It makes them feel good.
Hey, Tom.
It's not just to go out there and roll at the ball. Yes.
We're up against a break, so just hold that thought. We're going to get to some more of those suggestions and thoughts in just a moment on Radio Times. Tom Ferry is Executive Director of the Sports and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. We're talking about the decline in participation in youth sports across the country. And you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Stay with us. This is WHYY in Philadelphia. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we're talking about the decline of participation in youth sports, the cost of playing, access to good programs, the intensity needed to compete these days. Our guest for the remainder of the hour is Tom Ferry, Executive Director of the Sports and Society Program at the Aspen Institute and Project Play. And we've got some calls and comments coming in, 888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we're going to get to some of those comments in just a moment. But Tom, I wanted to pick up where we left off getting into the break. And that was talking about, as a parent, choosing a good program, finding good coaches. What are some of the red flags as to poor coaching? What do you want to avoid as a parent?
Well, I mean, what I would say is what you want is a coach that respects your child. That's what your child wants. Someone who can communicate clearly and in an age-appropriate manner. Someone who is organized and can set up a practice plan. Someone who understands that winning the game on Saturday is not actually the goal. While you want to compete and try to win the game, and otherwise, that, you know, your coach understands that you know, success means having that child want to sign up again the next year, and that they develop physical literacy, meaning all around movement skills and athleticism, and you put them on a pathway to play the sport, you know, into their teenage years and beyond once they're outside of your you know, control as a parent. So that's what you do want. You absolutely do not want coaches who are, you know, screamers. That does not mean there's not room for the raising of voice. I've seen coaches who, you know, have, you know, a little bit of intensity to them, but it's got to all be positive. If it's not positive, it's very difficult.
Well, how do they convey? I'm sorry. With constructive criticism, how do you convey that in a manner that helps the child?
Well, I mean, look, there are different techniques. I mean, one of which is, the praise sandwich, or, the Positive Coaching Alliance talks about the magic ratio, meaning five, positive comments for every one negative or, a critical comment. And that's challenging because that makes you have to work. You're going to be sincere about it. You have to work, sometimes work pretty hard to find those five. But, the research suggests that certainly even within marriages, when you have this ratio of five positive things to one negative thing, that, marriages do much better. And I think there's some truth to the idea of coaching as well. So you find, hey, listen, I really loved your effort out there. I liked how you used the inside of your left foot there. I know you've been working on it. That was terrific. And you saw that player over there on the side, and you hit them with the pass. What I need you to do now, or you would really benefit now, if you could just, learn how to loft that ball a little bit, over the top a bit more. I mean, just, set them up a little bit, him or her up a little bit more. Be just very mindful that kids don't need to be broken down. It requires that you work a bit, as a coach, but it's necessary.
All right, we've got lots of comments to get to, so let's get started. Email from Maureen. I think that what we see happening in youth sports goes along with the overall picture of what we see happening in education and children's lives in general. More pressure to succeed at earlier and earlier ages. We need to reevaluate how we are educating and raising our children. Increased anxiety and depression in children are not just about technology and social media. It's also because of these choices we've made in the education and recreation of our children. What do you think, Tom Ferry?
I agree. I mean, look, kids are under enormous stress today. Mental health is a real issue. We do know that sports in general provide positive psychosocial experiences. I mean, we've studied this at the Aspen Institute, and we have a big project that's coming out in October that will flesh this out further with data and original data and otherwise. I mean, sports can be a terrific thing in terms of helping children feel more connected to their peers, in terms of getting them some self-confidence. We do know that bodies in motion, just, what happens physiologically, is healthy and can be protective against mental illness. Where we need to be careful with sports is the whole pressurized thing. You got to win the game. We need to have that championship. When you start layering on those kinds of pressures on kids, especially at the 12 and under level, it really is just not, it's just not productive at all. I mean, we need to commit to developing every child who comes onto these teams and really investing in them so they can become the whole person that we all want them to be.
And so briefly, Tom, when we're talking about coaching and we're talking about not adding pressure, then there's the ride home in the family car. How should parents, there's a temptation to coach from the car. What do you suggest parents do after, say, a win or a loss or a game in which your child didn't play up to expectations?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been marinating in this for, 15 years now, and I've got a son who's 14 years old, and I'm still driving, and he's in the car seat, and I have to bite my tongue and think very strategically every single time about what I say. Right? You don't want to just like ignore the game like nothing just happened. But how do you communicate in a manner that is going to be supportive? I mean, I think the thing to know is that most kids are already putting a lot of pressure on themselves. They wanted to perform well. Things don't go well here and there. And so that's that. I mean, I think what parents can do, first and foremost, is to remind themselves how difficult these games are to play. You're just not going to get a hit every time you're up at bat. You're just not going to have a great first touch every time the ball comes to you on the soccer field. And so remember that, and if you can't remember that, get out there yourself and try it again. Try to play against your kids' teams. Watch them run circles around you. These are very difficult games to play. So start with like some empathy and some compassion, and then just, what I do is, I haven't mastered this. I think it's a very difficult thing, but I just like, how you doing? How'd you feel? How you play? Just, general neutral questions. If I get a sense that they're uncomfortable with the question, I just sort of back off and re-listen to the radio and and that's that, you know. But but I'm not his coach, and I shouldn't be his coach.
Let the coach do the coaching, you know, for the most part.
Let the coach be the coach, exactly. Yeah.
We've got an email from Ted, who is a volunteer coach. He says, I'm a volunteer coach for a local youth hockey club, and I work with the 9 to 10-year-old age group, where we focus on fun, learning skills, and healthy competition. Most kids drop out of youth hockey after age 12, as there are few opportunities for recreational leagues, and an emphasis on being competitive takes over. Kids get burnt out by year-round play, and parents who micromanage their play from the stands, in the car, etc. So Tom Ferry, there are a couple things to unpack there. First of all, we touched on the fact that there are fewer rec leagues at the top of the show. What is the advantage of, you know, we're not going to pit travel versus rec, but there are perhaps some advantages or some things that might work better for some kids in rec leagues. What is the disadvantage in having fewer rec leagues?
Well, look, rec leagues are essential because they're a heck of a lot more affordable. They're more accessible to kids from single-parent homes who can't drive their kid two counties away or two states away for all these tournaments all the time. They often meet the needs, the social needs of kids. I mean, kids like playing with their classmates, with people they know, and that's good. You know, we have seen this push toward travel going back really 20, 25 years now. And it started with hockey. It was hockey. The early forming travel teams started in hockey and moved to soccer and then basketball. And now it's really throughout all the sports, with exception maybe football. And it's, I don't know. We just need to bring back, in-town rec leagues, just local play. It can be done. It's just a matter of not giving the best ice time always to the travel teams or the field time always to the travel teams. You just have to make it a priority, and you have to make sure the coaches in those leagues know what they're doing. They have to be trained. One of the reasons parents flee these leagues is because it just doesn't seem like an experience that's going to allow their kid to stay involved in the sport. The coaches aren't, that good, or I mean, maybe well-meaning, but you're just like, oh boy, you know, my kid's not going to be able to play in the middle school, much less high school, if I keep them in this kind of environment. And so I think some very structural, intentional things need to be done to revitalize in-town leagues.
All right, an email from Colin. What impact do we feel that technology is having on youth sport participation? Video games still exist now as they did 25 years ago, but the ubiquity of the internet, mobile phones, WhatsApp, Instagram, etc., did not. Is that contributing to a decline in youth play, in your opinion?
I mean, technology is very, very good at giving kids experiences that they want. And the way they're able to do that is by, especially like video games, they're very good at kind of listening to their customer, meaning the child. I mean, you know, kids can play Madden or FIFA or Fortnite, you know, all day long. Why? Because they're just perfect competition experiences. You know, there's lots of action. There's lots of access to the action. You're playing. It's a social experience now because you're on headsets with your friends, or maybe they're sitting next to you. There's room for experimentation. If you screw up, you know, nobody yells at you. You start and stop when you want. You know, you have total ownership of the experience. It's in many ways, it's what we had as kids, a generation or two, where we would just hop on our bike and, you know, ride six blocks away and make up games out and play for whatever half hour or 4 hours or whatever else it may be, and come home at, you know, before the sun went down. It's they've like basically replicated the pickup sports experience in many ways. There's just no physical activity to it.
So what's the balance? What's the balance, Tom?
I think parents, you just have to show some discipline and not let technology be your babysitter all the time. You need to have some, you need to say, look, you can play if you're going to, play some real sports as well. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a responsibility from technology companies to be better actors here. I mean, it's funny, in China, they're so concerned about kids being monopolized by these online games that the government is not issuing new licenses to technology companies to create new online games. It's just the kids are becoming too nearsighted and they're too inactive. They recognize the problem of obesity and physical activity, and they're taking very strong structural changes. Harder to do in this country.
Yeah, I was going to say, not likely to happen here. But
Right. But I would like to see, but I do think it's, look, I mean, companies can be good actors, you know, and, you know, if the American Academy of Pediatrics says the kids should get no more than whatever, is it 2 hours of screen time a day, then fine.
Then that's what parents should probably.
After 2 hours.
Yeah. I just want to get to a couple more comments because we're fast approaching the top of the hour here. Nancy says, I was a high school science teacher, and over the years I've noticed the increase in injuries, even with girls in soccer getting concussions. I say that if I had that many injuries in science lab, I'd be fired. Why are parents so tolerant of injuries in sports? And again, we can marry that, Tom, to the fact that there's an increase in overuse injuries with kids playing year-round in one sport. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, the fundamental disconnect there is that sports are considered to be extracurricular and not co-curricular at most schools. And so, therefore, sport is seen as, a one-off activity. It's a privilege, and the coaches don't have to play by the same rules as the teachers, and they often don't come from the culture of teaching. They're often not teachers anymore themselves. So I think that's part of it. Yeah, I mean, coaches are, like, berating kids, and that happens all the time in high school sports. I mean, what if a teacher were to do that? I mean, they'd be fired the next day. We really do have this incredible double standard on how we treat kids in classroom settings versus, three doors away in the gym. And that's unfortunate, and that absolutely needs to change moving forward.
So, Tom, the state of play has come up with 8 strategies regarding youth sports. We won't have time to really get to maybe more than one of them here, but one that was interesting is reintroduce free play. So in your mind, what does free play look like, or does it look like anything?
Well, free play is child-owned play. It is them creating the environment, owning the experience. It's pickup. It's pickup soccer. It's pickup basketball. It is what free play looks like. What's interesting though is, and it's hard to say, let's just bring it all back, because everything changed in the 1980s when there were some child abductions and a few kids were killed, and there were these parental panics, and local TV went crazy with it, and now it's considered to be bad parenting to let your child hop on a bike and ride 6 blocks away and play at some park. Now you can get arrested for doing this kind of thing.
So we only have about 30 seconds left. I mean, could it look something like a group of parents just drops their kids off at a soccer field and says, I'll be back, in an hour, just here, bat the ball around if you guys want to. We'll take you out to pizza afterwards.
Yes, it's parents, facilitating just sort of monitoring activity at the end of the cul-de-sac, or it is coaches turning over the final 20% of practice to the kids and saying, hey, listen, this is your time here, and whoever scores the most goals with their weak foot, wins, and then completely stepping back. It's loosely supervised play.
Got it.
That gives parents the confidence their kids are being watched and cared for, but the kids still own the experience.
All right, well, that about wraps it up for this hour. Tom Ferry, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great, thanks for having me.
Tom is Executive Director of the Sports and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. And as always, we invite you to check out Radio Times on social media or listen to our podcasts. Head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for tuning in to Radio Times.